You're listening to Classic Business with Michael Avery, brought to you by Altron, there when it matters.
Welcome back to the Classic Business Show, brought to you by Altron Technology Partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. Altron, there when it matters. Well, we're discussing the real state of the economy ahead of tomorrow's sonar. We've got Lemkile Mondi of WITS, Dr. Asghar Adelzaidi, Director and Chief Economic Modeler at Applied Development Research Solutions, Jeff Jacobs, the President of the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry, as well as Zima Vavi, the Secretary General of SAFTU, Kuseni Dlamini, the Chair of MassMart and Aspen, and Professor Brian Cantor, Head of Research and Investec Wealth and Investment, all around the table trying to figure out a better way. And it feels like we're very good at talking, not so good at executing sometimes, Professor Cantor in South Africa. But I want to hone in on one point that Zweli mentioned, the fact that the policies of government have failed the black working class up to this point. Does that not mean that there is an indictment on the inflexible nature of our labour market and policies that have certainly favoured big firms contracting with big labour unions? Is it not time for us to start dialing back some of those, some would say, draconian labour protections?
Yes, protecting people in jobs. The notion that we have decent jobs for all, it's a false notion. The people in jobs enjoy protection. They enjoy a decent standard of living. But the poor in South Africa, and particularly the young poor, are not working. They don't have jobs. And they don't have jobs because the labor market, which equalizes supply and demand for labor, that's how it works, at a realistic wage rate. And those wage rates may be very low. So you have this dysfunction. You have regulations that really stand in the way of people finding work at wages that employers might be willing to pay. And those regulations, in fact, help prevent competition for the jobs that are mostly unionized or well paid. When we come to the way government spends its money, South Africa has a huge welfare system. People say South Africa is incomes are the most unequal in the world. That may be true, but it's also true that South Africa spends vast amounts of taxpayers' money on education, school education, university education, and on hospitals. So it's not for lack of spending that we're not getting outcomes. It's for lack of ability to deliver. And I think attention has to be given to the quality of the delivery. It's not for want of money that our schools fail. It's for want of good teaching and good supervision at the schools. And you can make the same point about our hospitals. So we have a dysfunctional labor market. Are we going to become less functional? Well, we just introduced in South Africa another huge bit of social engineering, which is minimum wages that are far above what most people actually have been earning. Now, what impact is that going to have on employment? It can't be helpful.
Well, I think we already saw in the first quarter in that shocking number.
Well, it was also the effect of slow growth. So slow growth affects employment, but wage rates also affect employment. And countries' economies do better when you stay out of the way of the labor market, out of the way of small business that might be willing to offer jobs, but for unskilled people that may well mean low wages. But if the economy grows over time, competition for labor increases, productivity improves, wage rates rise. Now, we're not seeing that in South Africa. And on the immigration front, I heard something on your radio station this morning about the rate of immigration of skilled people from South Africa over the last 10, 15 years. It's been devastatingly rapid. We've been losing skills. Our immigration policy should be open to people with skills, but it's not. So we have an immigration policy that says, on the one hand, unskilled people from the rest of Africa come in freely and play an important role in our economy. But people with skills are fundamentally kept out by the regulation. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Just one point, compliance, you mentioned that. The compliance factor in business. Now, why do we want so much compliance? Because we don't trust business. That's fundamental. Our officialdom has been brought up with a degree of hostility towards business. Hence, we don't trust business. We must force all these compliance upon them. That's something we should give up on. We don't have a blank slate. If you ask me what one would do immediately to stimulate growth, I agree with some of the previous comments on monetary policy. We should be encouraging more spending than we've been doing through monetary policy. That could give you a bit of a cyclical lift.
Mm. And we have seen from the Reserve Bank comment recently made by Lesetha Kanyaga that they're open now, according to their model, to rate cuts and a bit of easing from a monetary policy perspective.
A welcome acknowledgement that their forecasts of inflation have been too high and that their policies have been a bit too tough for the sake of economic growth. And if we got more growth, the rand would strengthen, not weaken. We'd attract more capital. Remember, this country of ours saves very little. We need foreign capital. How do you get foreign capital? Well, you've got to grow faster to get businesses to invest. And you can fund it with foreign capital. That's another one of our opportunities. If we grew faster, we would attract capital.
And I think you argued that in your book, if I remember correctly, that we don't have a savings problem, we have a growth problem, and the one will leverage the other. Jeff, I want to come back to the point that the professor raises about immigration. And on the other side of that equation are visa requirements. And we know that this is an issue that's on the president's agenda and radar, but it certainly has to be sorted out now. We need skills. We're bleeding skills on the other side of the coin. Peter Bruce mentioned in a Sunday Times column, I don't know when it was, the Italian restaurateur who employs 10 people who was being forced to close his business because the Department of Home Affairs refused to renew his son's work visa. I mean, that is policy lunacy.
Yeah. And we've seen that also with a local restaurant here in Cape Town, where it's a couple that runs the restaurant. The wife went overseas. Somehow or other, there was a problem. She couldn't come back into the country. And as a consequence of that, that business faced the real risk of closing down. And I agree with you, that's absolute lunacy. So when the Chamber talks about we need a lighter touch from government, that's really what we're talking about. We want government to loosen its hold through all these regulations. And I agree with the professor that it's because we don't trust business. We're not a business-friendly economy. And that needs to shift, that needs to change. Mm-hmm. And we're certainly hoping that in the SONA address tomorrow, we'll see some of those signals coming through. I think it's probably too early to see significant change happen, but we're hoping that the signal indication will come from the president. I was interested to hear what Zwelia had to say, and what worries me is that I don't think we have a common vision for the future of this country. We caught up in ideological debates, and I think we're sitting with a crisis situation, and I think what the Chamber has been trying to say, in a crisis mode, we need all hands on deck. We need everybody to have a common view of where we're going as a country, where the economy is going. And we need to actually put some of these ideological differences aside for the sake of growing the economy, for the sake of saving the country. We are losing skills at a rapid pace. The professor is absolutely right. We see that in the Chamber. We see member organizations folding. We see member organizations actually exiting Cape Town, exiting the economy. And that for us is a real concern.
And Kuseni, to add on to that, from big business's perspective, yes, policy is driven through a common vision. And I think we have far too many ideological shibboleths that need to be put to rest. I was just on a very eye-opening trip to Poland, which has enjoyed 29 years of uninterrupted economic GDP growth, along with Australia, the only country in the world to hold that. It's been a democratic country for 30 years, since 1989. And what did they do? Well, they did very simple things. They developed their human capital, they embraced business, they embraced markets, light touch government, all of these things that we've been speaking about, but they also had a very common vision. And between 17 different administrations in the last 30 years, from the centre to the left to the right, all of those finance ministers knew what good economic policy was, and they passed that good economic policy baton down the line, and they didn't veer from it. But we do have an opportunity here, Kuseni. We've got the Public-Private Growth Initiative. It was announced by Busa earlier this year, which is trying to bring business and government closer together. Are you confident that this has the potential now to become that spark or that catalyst to help overcome a lot of the distrust that has been the hallmark of certainly the last 10 years?
Yes, Michael, I'm very confident indeed that if we can execute on the social contract or compact that is emerging, or what I'll rather also call a patriotic alliance of some sort between labor, government and business in pursuit of a common national economic vision. That's what the likes of Poland have managed to do and do so well, and graduated from being emerging markets to being first world markets. And I think the point that Mr. Vavi mentioned around education is also an important one. That's an area where you need policy consistency and predictability. We've had lots of changes each time we have a new Minister of Education coming in terms of policy and in terms of the execution, which is why, as Brian was saying, we spend a lot, but what is not clear is whether we get the results and the outcomes that are desired to make us a world-class economy and society. And it's only the productivity of the expenditure that is required to be really deliver that we should focus on. And all the initiatives that are there, I mean, the 500 billion rand that can be unlocked from the public-private growth initiative, it's really encouraging indeed. The key thing is really implementation. We need to build the capacity to execute and deliver sustainable results that can start pushing back against unemployment, poverty, and the inequality that we face as a country. We don't have a shortage of good initiatives and good policies. We've had the summit after summit, but I think we need to move a step forward to start saying, how can we have implementation summits rather than talk shops, rather than talking about new policies, because we have all the good policies that are out there. Where we're lacking is really the processes, the systems, and the institutions that can turn policy into results that make a meaningful difference to our economy and society.
Zweli, I want to come back to a point that Jeff also raised, and that is this issue of trust between business and government, and also between business and labor. Would you admit that it is now time for labour in particular, for a more pragmatic approach? We do see very violent strikes in this country. We see very entrenched positions. Is now not the time? It's such a crisis moment, this, for us to reach across the divide and find each other.
Absolutely. That's absolutely necessary. Nobody in his right mind will say there's no need for business and labor to address the issues of the past 25 years, must we say, of the past of centuries of colonial and apartheid era. And let's not talk about South Africa's problem as if we emerging from a normal circumstances set of conditions that are not influenced by the history of apartheid, the history of colonialism, the history of oppression and exploitation and super exploitation of the black majority. So there is the need for us to talk and bridge the gulf. But that discussion must be honest. And the product of that discussion mustn't be a typical example of the chicken and the pig partnership to produce breakfast, where the chicken offers to lay eggs, but it asks that the pig offers a bacon, which can only be produced after the pig have been slaughtered. And I think that the reason why South Africa have become the most unequal society in the world, demonstrated by the fact that according to two leading companies that did a survey, one PwC and the other one, his name is just escaping me now, where they're saying that if you look at the executive pay of the top 100 listed Johannesburg Stock Exchange companies, you have a situation where on average they're earning 17 million. If you look at the Deloitte survey produced last year, they're talking 23 million rands on average a year. Now, you get the same people saying, well, we say nothing about those rates of exorbitant salary structure for the CEOs, but we keep on hammering on the black working class whose minimum wage or median salary was sitting at 3,400 rands as late as in 2014. whose national minimum wage now would have introduced that very minimally, not to escape poverty, not to do away with apartheid inherited inequalities and apartheid wage structure, not to help them escape the clutches of being the underprivileged. Surely, if you have a discussion about those issues, you've got to talk about the issue of fairness, about what this economy can afford. Can it afford to pay 23 million to others, but 3,500 others to the greater majority of the people who produce the wealth of the country? That's the ideological divide we've got to cross. Secondly, and my last point, I fundamentally always ask a question to everybody who seeks to blame the labor market inflexibility for the crisis of unemployment in South Africa, a simple question. Tell us which aspect of either the Basic Conditions of Employment Act or the Employment Equity or the Labor Relations Act or the Occupational Health and Safety Act point to us which clauses create a disincentive on the part of the employers to employ more workers, and or which clauses will not allow you to dismiss underperforming workers who are stealing and who are not playing by the rules of the company. No one ever points out exactly which aspects of the labor laws are preventing them from employing more workers, which goes back to the point. Whatever we can talk about issues of the labor market, they do not constitute the structural crisis South Africa's economy is facing, which leads to the rates of unemployment that we are having in the country. But still, the Conservatives, up to this point, always say only if we have more flexible, without explaining what do they mean. Only if we have more flexible labor market, we'll employ more people. And let me just say this. There will be no shared economic growth path in this country unless we do away with a neo-colonial structure of our economy that is based on extraction of our mineral resources and exportation to create jobs elsewhere in the world, only for them to come back as finished products. Until we address that as a structural deficiency, Ramaphosa can speak until he's blue in the face tomorrow, and he can use all of the brilliant words to try and encourage us to form part of the Tumamina Brigade. Nothing is going to change for the youth that are trapped in that unemployment crisis. Until we address the crisis of our education system, until we make sure that we can beneficiate our minerals and build secondary industries here in South Africa, until we can stop illicit cash outflows in our economy, and until we can discipline business to stop all of these tax dodging schemes, we will not have sufficient resources to address the need to re-industrialize our economy again.
I'd just like to point you to extensive research that has been done on the case for flexibility in South Africa's labor market. Go on, Google it. It's out there. We don't have time to rebut in chapter and verse, but it is well established that the rigidities in our labor market have caused firms to take a far more capital-intensive approach to growth, and the cost of labor as well has locked a very big chunk out of the labor market. Lumkile, as we wrap this up, I feel we haven't touched enough on Eskom. So I'd just like to find out from you, what's your base scenario for the Eskom rescue plan from here? Have you heard anything about debt to equity swaps?
Yes, I have. The plan is to split Eskom into three, I think, as the president had announced in February. We now have appointed a generation CEO, Peginumalo, and the two other divisions, that's distribution and transmission. The two have not appointed anyone yet, so the Minister of Public Enterprise is looking to fill those two positions, as well as the position of the Chief Restructuring Officer. The biggest challenge is what to do then with the 500 billion debt that is lying in the balance sheet of Eskom. And I think in that regard, There are different scenarios which are being looked at in the restructuring of ESCOM, because the idea is to ensure that each and every entity of the three ESCOM entities can stand on its own and account for every penny that it spends and that it receives. And that process, then you can understand what is needed in one entity to intervene to make sure that it can run efficiently and be productive in the generation process overall. So that plan is there. I think the biggest challenge for South Africa is that any restructuring that we're going to be doing has got a huge impact on the sovereign. Remember that ESCOM, given its size, and its level of indebtedness, it's become almost a quasi-sovereign. So any restructuring of the debt within the balance sheet will require the approval of lenders, because lenders basically in the restructuring process may find themselves exposed much deeper than they were before when ESCOM was a single entity. So those issues, I think the Minister of Finance next week will talk to how we're going to ensure that is being managed. But I think the essence really of what I'm getting in this discussion is a deep economic crisis that South Africa is facing, and really what Zweli was talking about, the complete restructuring of the economy, which was built on resources and exploitation of black labor, that until that pain is taken by all stakeholders, these discussions will be had in the next 5 years, and South Africa will continue failing and not addressing the core issues which emanate from the historical inequalities and the concentration of ownership, which need to be addressed now. Because if we don't do it now, I think we have missed a huge opportunity. I think the president must start talking to that, and any political settlement that we get into has to talk to that redress, talk to the restructuring and the pain that all South Africans have to endure going forward as we rebuild an inclusive economy, providing opportunities for everyone to participate.
Thanks, Lumkile. Brian, as we wrap up, the one thing that struck me about Poland is if any country had the right to look over its shoulder, to have a fairly big chip on its shoulder and complain, here's a country that was sandwiched between Russia and Germany through several world wars, that for the last 1,000 years was the victim of territorial disputes, that decided collectively in 1989 to move forward, to stop looking in the past in the rearview mirror. Can we do that?
Well, you hear these differences, huge differences of opinion. So we are far apart in opinion. The Polish model is a realistic one. We could take it, but we haven't. So how do we move forward? I mean, ownership. To say ownership is pensioners. South African owners are in pension funds. These pension funds own ESCOM debt. Would they be willing to swap their debt for an equity stake in ESCOM? Now, that would make ESCOM, in fact, like a private business to an important extent. Now, some of the debt is government guaranteed, some of it isn't. Can the government do a deal with the owners of ESCOM's debt, who are pension funds, that enable ESCOM at least to be financially viable? But if you ask me about ESCOM, priority number one is whatever it takes from now on, we've got to deliver the energy, the power. We don't do that, the economy contracts. So we've made a mess of ESCOM, a complete and utter mess. We've got to be realistic. We've got to recognize the mess, keep the power flowing, whatever it costs the taxpayer for now. And then think realistically and practically about how we can make ESCOM a decent business. And a decent business has to have private ownership. It's not run for the unions. It's not run for the people who work there, which is the case with ESCOM. A massive patronage system evolved there and got us into very big, big trouble.
And rather ironically, private ownership means that it's ownership by the very same workers through their pension funds. Professor Brian Cantor, yeah. Head of Research at Investec Wealth and Investment. Previously, he's now head of the new institute there. Chris Holdsworth is moving into that role. Thank you so much for joining us, and to the rest of my panelists tonight, Lunkile Mondi from Wits Business School, Dr. Askar Adelzadi, Director and Chief Economic Modeler at the Applied Development Research Solutions Group, Jeff Jacobs, the new President of the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Thank you so much. Great meeting you. And Zwelin Zima Vavi, Secretary General of SAFTU. And finally, Kuseni Dlamini, certainly not leastly, but lastly, Chair of MassMart and Aspen Pharmacare. Thanks so much for our State of the Nation preview ahead of a very key sonar address here in Cape Town tomorrow. If you've got any questions for any of our panelists, tweet us at Classic1027 or send us your WhatsApp on 066-470-1872. I'll be sure they get it. And that's also a wrap from the Classic Business team tonight. Thanks to sound engineers Matawa Tabaradebe here in Cape Town, Odi Wong Kabushi back in Johannesburg, and producer Andres Mahlangu. Kianete Fotwane is up next for you in Cape Town in the Jazz Lounge, and in Gauteng, Carolyn Stain is winding it down. Thanks for tuning in to Classic Business, which was brought to you by Altron, technology partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. Altron, there when it matters.